for the week of September 23rd, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 164, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Every week, Michael, we try and bring our good listeners all of the top entertainment and showbiz news. That's what we discuss on this show each week.
That's right. We watch the Emmy Awards, so you don't have to.
That's right. And in fact, we do it so that you could subscribe to the show on iTunes, or you could subscribe in the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher and any podcast aggregator. We really urge you to please subscribe to the show. Or, of course, you could email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Or you could call us. Our toll-free number is 888-567-7263. And I say this at the head of the show just so that people know that they can reach out to us, communicate with us, and follow us all the time.
Well, this week, what are they going to be following in the news?
Well, we followed it for them, of course, but we followed the Emmy Awards, and of course, they were last night. We'll tell you who won, who lost, what it all means, though I'm not really sure we can explain why the telecast was just so boring. Over in the world of music, it looks as if the sale of EMI to Universal Music is now, it's just a sure thing. Last week, the EU and the US both approved a deal that many in the music business see as the beginning of the end, and Michael is really going to tell us why it is going to bring on the zombie apocalypse.
I am? Okay.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not the zombie apocalypse, but it could, you know, mean a few changes in the music world. We'll end by speaking with our good friend Jeff Boucher, who you might know best as the editor of the Los Angeles Times Hero Complex blog. Well, Mr. Boucher is no longer with the Times. He'll be joining us to explain why and to fill us in on what he'll be doing next. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and as always, we cover box office worldwide. We take in all the figures from around the world to tell you which movies were number one everywhere. But the most interesting horse race was in North America this week, where three movies were so tightly locked in a battle for first place, you could barely see any daylight between them. They were the horror film House at the End of the Street, starring Jennifer Lawrence, the drama End of Watch, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and Clint Eastwood and Justin Timberlake, starring in Trouble with the Curve. All three of them made just around $13 million. They settled out a little bit once the weekend ended, but we'll probably get some revised figures today or tomorrow. But as far as we can tell there, it's one of the closest horse races I've seen in a while. And it's almost as astonishing as the fact that I said the phrase, a film starring Clint Eastwood and Justin Timberlake.
Well, wait a second. That film stars Clint Eastwood, Justin Timberlake, and Amy Ryan? No, Amy
I'm not saying it. Yes, but I'm not surprised
Amy Adams.
Amy Adams. I'm not surprised that Amy Adams stars in a film with Clint Eastwood. I think Justin Timberlake is a pretty talented actor. He's getting better all the time. Nonetheless, I never thought the words Justin Timberlake and Clint Eastwood starring in a film would ever come out of my mouth.
Yeah, well, you know, it's better than saying Clint Eastwood and an empty chair.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, the number one movie around the world is Resident Evil Retribution. It grossed another $37 million. It's at $137 million and counting. At number two is End of Watch, the Jake Gyllenhaal film. That's tied with House at the End of the Street. Both of them made $13 million. As you can tell by the fact that those two movies are tied at number two, it was a very quiet weekend overseas. Not a lot of people went to the movies because those films triumphed just by their North American numbers. At number four is the Clint Eastwood film Trouble with the Curve, a baseball movie. It grossed $12.7 million. At number five is Finding Nemo, which has been re-released in 3D. It grossed $12 million worldwide. That's sort of a rough estimate. It's made $38 million and counting. At number six is The Bourne Legacy, which grossed another $10 million. It's at $213 million worldwide. And surprisingly, when you look back at the Bourne film starring Matt Damon, the first one only made $213 million worldwide. The second one made $288 million, and it was the third one that really exploded. That made $442 million worldwide, but that was made on a very similar budget to this film. That film cost $130 million to make. This film cost $125 million to make, and that's why this reboot is still not as successful as the studio would have liked. Yeah. At number seven is Ted, the Seth MacFarlane film. It made $9 million. It's at $420 million and counting. If you were watching the Emmy Awards, this explains why Seth MacFarlane was smiling so much.
Well, he smiles a lot to begin with. I mean, the guy's got, like, you know, headlights for teeth. I mean, but at the same time, you know, he had a little flub there where he kind of lined up in the wrong spot and started giving his little introduction, and there was no microphone. So he had to, like, walk all the way across the stage to reach the microphone.
Frankly, I wasn't even sure if it was a joke or not.
Yeah, neither was I. I thought, is that supposed to be some bit? Because, but I don't think it was. I mean, he actually kind of said, oops, I guess next time I will come to rehearsal.
At number eight is Dredd, the remake of the Judge Dredd film based on the comic book series. That made $6.3 million. It debuted basically in North America only. At number nine, perhaps the most notable news in box office was the expansion of The Master, the Paul Thomas Anderson film starring Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman. It grossed $5 million. It's at $6 million total and counting. It expanded to about 800 screens and grossed a solid $6,000 per screen. I think that's just about the right level for this movie. We'll see how it holds next week and down the road. Obviously, they're expecting award nominations, certainly from the critics, if not from the Oscars. And they will perhaps expand it again or bring it out to a wider release in December or January. But this feels right about the right level where a movie like this should be playing at.
Yeah. That's $6,000 per screen. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's a good amount of money for a film like this. Again, it's not a crowd-pleasing movie. It's a serious art film, I have to say. And it's tied with several other films, all of whom made $5 million. Brave, the Pixar film, which passed the $500 million mark this weekend. Madagascar 3, which grossed another $5 million. It's at $627 million. And The Dark Knight Rises, which added another $5 million to its billion-dollar total. Along with Paranorman, the stop-motion animated film, that made $5 million. It's at $82 million worldwide and counting. And down at number 14 is the Ridley Scott film Prometheus, long gone from North American screens, but it grossed another $4 million overseas, and it just passed, or it will pass, I should say, in a few days, the $400 million mark.
Now, you said that the biggest story this week was what?
The expansion of The Master.
Right, okay, that's right. Now, I would... I don't want to say argue, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's one of the bigger stories. I would say End of Watch is a big story, and here's why. End of Watch came in number one. It made tied for number one, made $13 million this past week. End of Watch was released by Open Road Films. Do you remember what Open Road Films is? What company that is?
I forget.
This is the company that was started by AMC and Regal, or was it Regal and Cinemark? But basically, it's I know it's AMC, actually. But it is a group of U.S. North American movie theater chains have decided to start their own distribution company to release films that wouldn't otherwise get released, kind of more independent, spirited, so that they don't have to rely just on the studios. And now these were supposed to be smaller films, mind you. Now, they're coming in number one at the box office.
It is AMC and Regal. Regal, of course, is the largest theater chain in North America. We'll be hearing more about them later. And it's not the only one. They've got Red Dawn, which has been sitting on the shelf for ages. That's finally coming out November 21st, circa Open Road. That's a movie that had just fallen through the cracks for some reason, couldn't get released. I'm not quite sure why, even though it's bursting with young talent. So again, they're stepping up with a movie that is certainly not a modest film. You know, they expect to be up there in the box office with that one. It's opening right around Thanksgiving, so they're becoming players.
That's right. Now, why do I say this is big news? I mean, so what? So some new distributor comes along and releases all these movies. Big deal, right? And not that we're moving into that particular segment. But the reason I say this is because there is a little decree that was handed down by the Supreme Court in 1948. It was called the Paramount Decree, which forbid studios from owning movie theater chains. So you couldn't be vertically integrated. You couldn't manufacture the content, own the means of distribution, and the means of selling the content. Well, of course, that's not true now necessarily in the television world with Comcast owning Universal and NBC. And now you're seeing it's not true. A movie theater chain can go in reverse and actually own a distributor. So what's stopping a distributor like Sony from, say, purchasing Regal?
Apparently not a lot, especially if the Supreme Court says go right ahead.
Well, the Supreme Court has never said that. It's just that people have been looking the other way. Now, I guess a decree is different from a ruling. I guess that's part of the issue, is that it's not wasn't a law necessarily that was overturned or anything. It was a decree, and I know that there are legal ramifications for that kind of verbiage, at least in the U.S. But I think, you know, look, Open Road Films, the way they kind of started out was, no, these are just, we're just going to release a few films on some screens that nobody's using and or paying attention to.
So it's a good week for Jake Gyllenhaal, who starred in that film and also made his off-Broadway debut. But this step forward by Open Road, does it concern you?
I don't know. I mean, I think time will tell. I think what would be concerning is if you wind up with, you know, Sony or Paramount or Warner Brothers owning a big movie theater chain, because then you're just going to get those distributors. It will be like the 1920s and 30s all over again.
But isn't there so much more competition? It won't be like the 20s or 30s all over again.
Well, that's what everybody's saying. We'll see. I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. NBC puts on NBC shows.
Right. Yes. But then they say, well, we're going to cancel this show because we're going to, you know, put our show in a better time slot. The show
they do that all the time.
Right.
They,
and that's actually been a bit of a problem. And that's one of the things that the 1996 Telecommunications Act, or the restructuring of it, allowed. And a lot of people say that wasn't such a good thing.
So this is a significant step by Open Road. They're not doing small little indie films. This is a big film with a big star. They have bigger titles coming out down the road. They have the host.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a big film. It's a small film. It's a small independent film that they marketed big, and it turned out well.
Any movie with Jake Gyllenhaal is, you know, notable. He's a big movie star. It's not exactly, you know,
right,
a tiny movie. Jake Gyllenhaal and the screenwriter behind Oscar-winning films. It's not exactly, you know, the little movie that could.
Right, exactly. It's not a Lena Dunham production before she was known.
Yes, exactly. It's not, you know, and IFC, of course, does vertical distribution all the time. They own the theater chain. They own the movie. They own the cable channel. They own the streaming and video rights to their movies. So we're seeing this more and more.
Yes, but name IFC's last three releases. Now, you probably can, but name their last three releases.
I understand. I get your point.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, okay, you can be vertically integrated when, frankly, nobody cares about what you're integrating. But, and I'm not saying that means IFC's movies are bad. I'm just saying that they are for niche audiences and they have a limited market.
They're genuinely small films.
Yes. They make $13 million in their lifetime, including cable, television. If they're lucky. Correct. Yeah. They don't make $13 million in one weekend in, you know, theatrical release.
Well, Open Road is not the only distributor to have a good weekend. Summit, another company touting an independent film, had a very good weekend. The Perks of Being a Wallflower is an independent movie. It was released on four screens, and it grossed a very impressive $61,000 per screen for a $244,000 total. That was perhaps the biggest news in independent releases. It's based on a coming-of-age novel by Stephen Chbosky, who went from that book, which was published by MTV, of all people, in 1999, went on to sell hundreds of thousands of copies, I think around 700,000 to be exact. He went into television, and now he's come full circle to adapt his own book and direct it for the big screen. It stars Emma Watson of Harry Potter and Logan Lerman of the Percy Jackson film and the show I know him best for, the TV series Jack and Bobby. So
it seems like all of these, like, these kidlets, as I like to call them, these kid stars are like trying to grow up, and now they're starring in romantic comedies.
Well, it's a serious coming of age drama. It's an angst ridden film. He's a high school kid, so it's not like they're trying to grow out of their age.
Okay.
If you're under 25, you probably know this book. It's not a great book. I've read it. It's okay. It's a fairly routine coming of age tale. It's got a gay subplot, so that makes it a little more modern, I suppose, than others. But it's your usual angst ridden teen who's reading great books and great music and getting mentored by older kids and a teacher that he thinks is really cool and trying to figure out life. But I'm not surprised to see it do well at this level. We'll have to see if they can expand it out. But clearly there's an audience for this film after years and years of being a really popular young adult novel.
And who was it written by?
Stephen Chbosky.
Yeah, I just wanted you to say that one more time.
Thanks very much. He worked on the TV show. It was the TV show about... It's the TV show about, a post-apocalyptic America. And they tried to re-promote the show by sending Tabasco sauce to the network. What was that show?
Tabasco sauce to the network. I don't know, but it was hot. Get it? Get it? Hot? Get it? But, you know, speaking of television, I guess maybe that's a nice little cue, a nice little segue, which we're not supposed to actually mention our segues.
Jericho.
Okay, yes. Oh, Jericho. That's right. Yes.
Mystery. That starred Skeet Ulrich. I couldn't remember his name either. Forgive me, Skeet.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure he's happy somebody remembers his name. But in any case, moving along into television, it's a perfect segue to our television news. And this week, as we mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to be talking about the Emmys. Modern Family, kept winning for Best Comedy Series, and Mad Men did not win for Best Drama.
Well, no show has ever won 5 years in a row. Mad Men had won it 4 years in a row, and blessedly, thank God, they did not repeat. Especially because, well, the Mad Men people said, no one's ever done it. We didn't expect to win. But this last season was so awful.
Although you do stand in the minority there. A lot of people felt like it was the best season. So
No. Not a lot of people do not think it was the best season. Who said that? It's the best season ever on Mad Men? Who the heck said that?
In both the New York Times and the LA Times said, well, you know, a lot of people felt this, but...
Show me the link.
Oh, brother.
I don't buy that.
Show me the link. What is that, like a new Show Me the Money?
So they didn't say it was the best season ever. They said others think. They're just reporting industry ideas. It wasn't that they reviewed the season and said, this is the best season ever. You're simply saying they felt like others believe.
That was one of the stronger seasons. But anyway, let's move on to who else won during this year's Emmys.
Family is notable because it's on a major network. And it basically kept the lights on for the networks. If you're a comedy or a drama, chances are you are on cable. It's been happening for years. Cable dominated again. And it's no surprise. I mean, there are 200 cable channels and 3 or 4 or 5 major networks, if you count PBS. So why wouldn't cable dominate? It would be bizarre if they didn't. But Modern Family did win 3 years in a row. That's an impressive company to keep. There's only a handful of shows that have done that. Specifically, The Dick Van Dyke Show, All in the Family, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Taxi, Frasier, and 30 Rock. That's great company to keep. They're all pretty much classic shows by most people's standards. I don't love 30 Rock, but many other people do. It happens virtually every decade that a sitcom gets on a roll and dominates the Emmys like this. The only show to win it more than 3 times in a row, of course, is Frasier, which won it 5 times in a row. And other shows have won Best Sitcom 3 times, just not in a row. But still, it's pretty rarefied air for Modern Family.
Not even Seinfeld has won 3 times.
No, not even close.
Yeah.
But the thing I found annoying was all their acceptance speeches. It's been 3 years, and they all felt embarrassed and ashamed to win an award. Bowen, Stone Street, everybody seemed to apologize for winning. It got very old very quickly, I felt.
You know, certainly I think a lot of people felt Sofia Vergara was going to win that award. But I think a lot of the Emmy, I wouldn't be surprised if the Academy, the Television Academy, is kind of jealous of her. I mean, she's in every commercial around. I mean, she's a spokesperson for half the products being sold today, at least in the U.S. She's incredibly beautiful, and she's, you know, on this hit television show. What more could you want in life?
Well, I don't think that's the reason why she didn't win. I think it's just their rote tradition of just repeating people over and over again. But frankly, Bowen, Ms. Bowen, Mr. Stone Street, if you're ashamed of winning, don't submit your name next year. And that will guarantee you don't steal an Emmy from your coworkers. If you really don't want to win again next year, don't submit your name. Take a year off. See if she wins. Then you can come right back the following year.
But is that totally up to them? Because, again...
Well, they could decide. You know, they have contracts, which probably give them a bonus of money if they win an Emmy. They probably all have that clause. But you know what? They're all richer than God already, so they don't need to worry about that.
They've
all got great contracts. Yes, their managers, their agents, other people, the show wants more accolades, but it's absolutely up to them. If they say, Bill Cosby never submitted himself, he didn't want to compete with others for Emmy Awards. He said, I'm not going in that race. He never did it.
The irony, I think, in our reporting here is that we have not said the name once, I don't think, at least I haven't, of the drama that actually won the top award last night. We've mentioned
ironic. We're getting there.
Yeah, okay, because, you know, we've actually had an argument about Mad Men, which didn't win last night, but Homeland did. This is the show about, I have no idea what this show is about, actually. Why don't you tell us, Michael, because I know that you are familiar with this show just from having watched the Emmys last night. You know what this show is about.
That's very funny. Yes, my biggest complaint about the Emmys, as always, is you can watch a 3-hour broadcast celebrating the best in television and have no idea what the shows they honored are about. You could not figure out what Homeland was about by watching that 3-hour show.
I know what it's about. Pick me. I think it's about Claire Danes yelling into a mobile or cellular telephone or at another character, often wearing a hat.
Well, yes, you could watch Modern Family clips and get an idea. It's a sitcom. You can tell Homeland is a drama involving some political conspiracy. It's about a soldier who was a POW coming back to the U.S. That's Damian Lewis. And Claire Danes is a government official who believes he is a turncoat, a spy, a plant by Al-Qaeda or some other foreign group, and is going to wreak havoc in America, and he's going to turn on his own country. That is the plot of season one. The show got great reviews. It's thrilling to see it win Best Drama first time out. You might think that's hard to do. It's not easy, certainly, but it's not unusual. The New York Times began their coverage of the Emmy Awards by saying, quote, "It's never easy to be a freshman television show vying for an Emmy Award against the most popular upperclassmen." Actually, it's not easy, but it happens a lot. You look back on television history, and a lot of shows have won the Emmy for Best Drama their first season out. They include The Defenders, a classic early legal drama, Mission Impossible, The Waltons, Hill Street Blues, the greatest and most important TV show of all time, L.A. Law, 30-something, Picket Fences, The Practice, The West Wing, Lost, which deservedly won for its first season, and even more deservedly, never won it again after that, and Mad Men, which, of course, has won it for 4 years in a row. So Homeland enters that august company, but you can see from the 50s on, it happens pretty regularly, and I haven't even included anthology shows and other shows that early on in TV's reign probably won their first time out as well. That's a partial list of the shows that have won the top drama award their first season out. So there's a long story tradition of this. It ain't easy to win an Emmy, of course, but it's been done by some of the biggest shows in TV history, and Homeland will hopefully maintain its standards. It won for Best Drama, Best Actor for Damian Lewis, Best Actress for Claire Danes, who of course made her name on My So-Called Life, and Best Writing and Best Directing. No, not Best Directing, Best Drama. I have to say, I thought the speeches last night were poor.
Boring.
But the acceptance speech for Homeland, I thought, was very gracious indeed. The producer of Homeland began by acknowledging Showtime and the fact that they were winning their Best Series Award for the first time ever. You know, it's a big breakthrough for them, being on the heels of HBO, always the also-ran, always the, you know, redheaded stepchild compared to HBO. And he tipped his hat to them. And more importantly and more graciously, he tipped his hat to the other quality shows on Showtime that paved the way for Homeland. And he mentioned Dexter, Weeds, and Nurse Jackie by name. I thought that was a very nice touch by him.
Yes. And you know, I do think in that list of titles that you gave, you know, of series that have won their first year out, Mission Impossible, I think we're going to have to remove that because, of course, that's the Tom Cruise starring the film, you know, the franchise.
Of course, it's based on a TV show.
It is?
Yes, yes.
Oh. Mm.
Another big winner was Game Change, the HBO movie, which triumphed in the miniseries and TV movie category. It's the HBO film about Sarah Palin, and it won Best Actress for Julianne Moore, Best TV Movie or Miniseries, Best Directing, and my favorite award was for Best Writing for Danny Strong, who's an actor from Gilmore Girls that I always liked on that show and was happy to see him expanding his talents into other areas.
But do you think, I mean, I look at this and kind of go, you know, Julianne Moore, you know, because whenever you get to these miniseries ones, it always seems like, hey, you're a really good television actor, Mr. Kelsey Grammer, you're not going to win because you're up against, you know, Danny DeVito. Well, not Danny DeVito. That's a bad example. Al Pacino or insert name of big, you know, movie star. So Julianne Moore, big movie star. She shows up at the Emmys and, you know, sure, you're going to walk away with the Emmy because you're the big movie star starring in a miniseries.
Well, I think that might have been true in the 70s and 80s when they were thrilled when a movie star deigned to do a television show or a movie or a miniseries. You know, Henry Fonda does Gideon's Trumpet. Oh, my God, of course you're going to give him the Emmy. A, it's been happening since the beginning of television. B, I think the dividing line between TV and movies and the level of quality on TV versus movies doesn't mean television has an inferiority complex at all. I think movie actors come to TV to work because there are good roles. Jessica Lange won for American Horror Story. She's thrilled to have a role written for her, frankly. Not that she's not a terrific actress and doesn't deserve to make movies, but women over 30 who don't look like starlets don't always have great roles for them in movies, but on television, they flourish. So I don't think it's a sense of like, oh, you're a movie star, you're superior to us, we have to give you the award. I think it's talented actors in movies coming to TV to do the best work that they can find. Louis C.K., of course, also won a writing award. He won two of them for his TV series and for his special, which we talked about a lot, being a show that he did himself and released online and made free as a digital download and asked people to pay him if they would.
I know that, talk about a success story. I mean, the guy not only made a mint doing that and, you know, made it for himself rather than a network, but then he goes on to win an Emmy for it.
Well, we don't know that he made a mint. We know that he was financially successful.
He actually explained how much he made. He laid it all out there.
I know he did, but the final tally was possible. It was possible that he might have made as much if he'd sold it to someone outright and not had all the hassle and work to put into it. If you think about all the hours he put into doing it this way, it may have been a break-even situation, but he had more control, he was more satisfied, and all that sort of stuff. And of course, he gets the ultimate satisfaction of winning an Emmy Award, just like The Daily Show, which won for the 10th time in a row, and The Amazing Race, which won for 9 out of 10 times.
Yes, Amazing Race, 9 out of 10. I mean, come on, there aren't other reality shows on television? Come on, people. Just, you know, look at the DVDs that people send you so you know who else you can vote for. The Daily Show, look, it's one of the best shows on television as far as I'm concerned, and I love that show. I thought Jon Stewart's speech was one of the better ones given, and he unfortunately was bleeped as he kind of finished his speech, but basically he was saying, you know, that years from now, you know, eons from now, when the world is just an empty husk because we've bled it dry of all its natural resources, that there'll be a box of Emmys sitting around, and when the aliens come, they'll know just how boring these bleep, and the bleep was, you know, these effing award shows really are.
Right, and this is an example, like you say, of, is it really up to Jon Stewart to keep submitting his show? They had a big joke with Jimmy Fallon, and who was the other one? Oh, Stephen Colbert, literally grabbing at his legs and trying to keep him from going on stage to accept this award. It's a big mishmash of a category where they combine sketch shows like Saturday Night Live and The Daily Show with talk shows like Jimmy Fallon. It's just a mess of an award category. It's a very good show. It has a short half-life. But more importantly, if you saw the people on stage, there were a lot of new faces.
Yes,
and
that is true.
It represents a lot of people. There's a lot of turnover in the staff. There are people who won this show for multiple times, and there are people who won their very first Emmy. So I can understand why Jon Stewart would keep submitting his show, because it reflects on a lot of people who get a chance, perhaps for the first and only time in their career, to say, I'm an Emmy winner.
That's right. So, I mean, it's like Saturday Night Live not submitting its show because they won in 1980. Yeah, well, in 1980, you had Eddie Murphy on. And, you know,
well, if they won for 30 years in a row, they might be a little embarrassed. But,
yes, that's true.
But nonetheless, they've got a lot of new cast members. It's their first chance. And again, you saw cast members of SNL being nominated in Best Comedy category. It just feels awkward.
Yeah, you know, what I thought actually one of the best moments was when Amy Poehler did not win for Parks and Rec. And gosh, who won? It was Julia Louis-Dreyfus for what is she in? Veep, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So she gets up on stage and starts reading a speech that she had written down, and it was Amy Poehler's speech. And
right. And when they clutched hands before she went on stage and exchanged notes, that was the gag, that she had accidentally handed her notes when right. they clutched hands. So you could see them, if you rewound, saw when they did the little gimmick. It was cute.
Yes, and if you rewound, of course, everybody was on, you know, some kind of TiVo. But what I thought was interesting was they tried to play Julia Louis-Dreyfus off. Hey, you're taking too long. And the whole time I'm thinking, why are you playing her off? This is probably the best bit you've got going the entire show. And you're going to play her off?
Yes, I thought it was a nice touch when the director of the show played himself off. Of course, he knew he was going to play himself off, and he said so. And he still managed to fit in everyone he wanted. But it was a nice gesture to the fact that he keeps cutting people off. It was tacky. They did it with the writers. They rarely did it with the biggest stars. But Tom Berenger of The Big Chill, that's where I always think of him, he won for Hatfields and McCoys, the History Channel miniseries. And I don't think he'd ever won an award before in his life based on he thought he was going to have half an hour to talk. He was starting, and he clearly had no end in sight. He's never even seen an award show, apparently. It was going to go on for a day. You could tell. They were like, oh, my God. I mean, he wasn't even close to beginning.
Kevin Costner
had to play him off.
Yeah, Kevin Costner was headed down that same road there, and he won for – what did he win for?
Best actor for Hatfields and McCoys.
Yeah, okay. I don't even know.
Well, I don't think he came within a country mile of Tom Berenger. That was a speech that clearly was going to be a marathon. There was a famous Oscar speech, I think, like she spoke for 2 hours or something like that,
yeah.
You know, back in the early days. And that's when they just said, you know what? We're going to have a time limit.
Well, you know, Kevin Costner kind of looked at the award and he said, you know, this kind of looking at the award reminds me of the Olympics. And I was like, oh, no, Kevin, don't go there. Don't just come on, get back on track here. And he did kind of get back on track. There was that little blip where he was like, where, what are you talking
about? Reassociating? I don't know.
Yeah, what are you talking about? And then he was like, but I love being an actor. And, you know, I just, okay, whatever. And it kind of, you know, as you point out in the notes, it ended on time. That was kind
of the most notable fact of Jimmy Kimmel's hosting. It ended on time.
Yes, again, you said that. I mean, he's not bad. It's just
he kept the laughs short.
Yes.
Well done, Jimmy.
Unlike our show.
The same thing I would say about the show is that the producers don't have control. They'd love to eliminate some of the categories that are shown on air. They've talked about rotating and doing writing one year and directing the next and directing one year and writing the next. You know, there are hundreds of dozens of categories that don't get on the air. They'd love to eliminate some of the categories that do get on the air and have more time for the big awards and make more of a show of them. Then perhaps they'd have more time to do a clip job explaining what Homeland and the other best drama nominees actually were and the best sitcoms. Why not? That's the whole point of the show. So I know their hands are tied a little bit, but still, I think it's ridiculous that you can spend 3 hours and have no idea what won and why.
Well, you know, as important as we might think the Emmys are, the reality is...
Do we?
Well, I don't necessarily. I mean, they're critically important, I suppose, and they're important.
Are they?
Oh, geez. The reality is, I guess what I'm saying is, you look at Mad Men, you look at Homeland, and you look at their audiences. Okay, maybe not Homeland, but certainly Mad Men. The people who watch a single episode of Mad Men, not only on its first run, but it's on its live plus seven, as they say, if you got that kind of viewership on a broadcast network, CBS, NBC, Fox, ABC, you would be canceled. So you might win an Emmy Award for best drama as Mad Men, but you could never make it in, you know, if you were in the big boys club, so to speak, quote unquote.
It's a different playing field, of course, but that's nothing to do with the quality.
No, not at all. Not at all. I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean, they say, oh, it's not fair. They only have to do 12 episodes instead of 20, or they don't have to have as big an audience. Well, you know, tough. it's like, that's like saying only the highest grossing films of the year deserve to win the Oscar for Best Picture. They almost never do win the Oscar for Best Picture.
That's correct.
And there's no reason why they should. But yeah, the same is true of Homeland. It is not a big smash hit. The finale of season one received 1.7 million viewers. That's quite good for Showtime, but it's certainly not... major network level.
Well, now it means I might have to watch the rest of the series.
Well, it just came out on Blu-ray and DVD, so that just came out in the last 2 weeks. So did Modern Family. In this day and age, there's no reason not to catch up on television. It's always available to you all the time.
Well, you know, television is one thing. Music is another. Trying to catch up on all the music being released is almost impossible these days, what with all of the independent record labels that are popping up. In fact, there are so many independent record labels popping up that the big six are they're not profitable anymore.
Is that why they're merging? Do you think the independent record labels have siphoned away the business of the major record labels? Isn't it just the fact that people are ripping off music online?
Yes, but that was a softball that I was setting up for you to say, big six, there are only three now.
But it was inaccurate.
Oh, okay. Well, I was trying to lay down some something for Michael to riff on. But the reality is, you're right. It's piracy. It's a number of issues, and of course, this has led to six big record companies kind of slowly whittling down to what is now three from four. EMI was the fourth one. It is split up, and now most of it is being sold off to Universal Music Group. It had to go through some regulatory bodies in the EU and in the United States and in Australia and in Japan. It passed in the EU. The EU said, yeah, sure, you can, Universal Music Group, you can buy this portion of EMI, provided the following. And there was a whole list of assets that EMI had to sell off before Universal could merge with it or pick
well,
up.
I thought that EMI. Was the EU that did most of that paring down.
That's what I said. EU.
Oh, I thought you said the U.S.
No, the EU basically said, you know, hey, you've got to sell your units in France, Spain, Belgium, Denmark, Poland, Czech Republic, Portugal, Sweden, and Norway, and you have to get rid of all of these labels, Parlophone, which, you know, is the home to Coldplay and Queen, and Chrysalis, EMI Classics, Ensign, Virgin Classics, a whole bunch of labels. And however, EMI is keeping a small little catalog known as the Beatles.
Right, they're not out of their minds. In short, there were four big record labels, and now there are three, with Universal purchasing EMI. Essentially, they had to sell off about 30% of the company they were buying, about 30% of the assets. The combined company is 10% smaller than it might have been otherwise, but that's the deal. So now we have three record labels left, Sony, Warner Brothers, and Universal. And just 14 years ago, there were six.
Right.
So you can see.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, a lot of the industry pundits are saying, this is a horrible, you know, now there's only three and this is going to be terrible for the music business. And then there are others who say, well, what do you mean? There's all these independent record labels and, you know,
it's easier than ever to get your music out.
Yes, that's right. You can release the music yourself straight through on iTunes or through Topspin. But the reality is these record companies actually account for close to, and I'm going to get this wrong, but it is a large majority of the money being made in the music business, at least on recorded music.
Is it 80%, 90%?
I wanted to say 85%, but I knew I would get it wrong. And so I'm not going to say how much. I'll have to look that up. But the big four, now the big three, do account for a majority of money made on recorded music. And the U.S., you know, kind of rubber stamped this. And I'm not saying I'm for it or against it because I don't really have an opinion either way. They basically rubber stamped this sale by saying, look, you know, EMI is a catalog company. They've got a deep catalog of older artists, whereas Universal Music, they're really focusing and concentrating on up and coming and new artists. So really, it's a complimentary offering.
So everybody's happy.
EMI and Universal are happy. And Citigroup, which owned EMI, they made an investment in EMI. They're very happy because they've unloaded it.
Did it pay off for them?
I don't think so. No, not at all.
Well, then they're not exactly happy. They're just getting away without losing their shirt.
They may have lost their shirt.
And that's, of course, what exactly might happen if you sign up with one of those big three record labels. Even if you're someone as powerful as James Taylor, it can be a nightmare to deal with your record label. He's been going back and forth in lawsuits against Warner Brothers Records for years now, starting, I think, in 2004, is this recent round of back and forth. They've been auditing Warner Brothers. They've been coming to an agreement.
Well, it's not a lawsuit. It wasn't a lawsuit in 2004. He's been auditing them since 2004, and he's had grievances since 2004.
And it's finally going to court, or I'm sure parts of it have gone to court before, or maybe this is the first time. I don't know, but we've linked to a story in Digital Music News, which gives you a blow-by-blow description of the many ways Warner Brothers reportedly has ripped off James Taylor, including, you know, selling his greatest hits album, which is one of the best-selling albums of all time, for like a sub-budget price. Everything from tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars and ripping them off to like $800 here and $2,000 there and $14,000 there. The myriad ways in which they have, you know, nickeled and dimed him and not reported earnings is kind of fascinating to read. We've got the link in our show notes. If you're interested at all, check it out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. You know, here, just number seven. Also, during the audit, Taylor found that Warner Brothers had miscalculated customer returns into various royalty and non-royalty bearing buckets. The result was an $800 shortfall in the record company's favor.
$800. And you laugh at that. But as you see, they go through, of course, they're going to list every discrepancy they find. And you see some are in the thousands of dollars or hundreds of dollars, then tens of thousands and 100,000.
Right.
So it adds up pretty quickly.
Right. I mean, basically, the case being made here is, look, this is endemic in the way they're treating me. But what I thought was interesting is that the title of this, the headline says 50 Ways to Screw an Artist by Warner Brothers Records. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't 50 ways? I mean, basically, it's a riff on 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, which was a Paul Simon song.
That's right.
So why attach it to James Taylor?
So they should have made a play on Fire and Rain or something like that?
Yeah. Or, you know, the record company's not a friend.
Okay.
Who knows? You know, ultimately, I don't know. For it's $2 million, I'm sure Warner Brothers Records doesn't think it's a big deal.
I see what you're doing.
Yes, that's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about baseball on television. Just as the major networks keep claiming bigger and bigger bucks despite shrinking primetime audiences, baseball has racked up huge deals for its TV rights. In fact, baseball scored a double play while playing the field. Get it? See what we did there?
I see what you did.
Okay. First, they doubled the amount. Doubled, get it? The amount ESPN paid for its package of games. Now they've essentially doubled the price paid by Fox and Turner Sports. Fox will be paying $500 million a year through, I want to say, 2022. Is that correct?
I bet you're right.
Yeah. Or $4 billion in all. Turner is paying $350 million a year for a grand total of $2.8 billion.
And those numbers work out because these new deals do not start today. There are older deals that need to expire.
That's right. Add in ESPN's haul, and you're looking at $1.5 billion a year. That's every single year just for the key games. This does not include the majority of games which provide the cornerstone of regional and local channels like the YES Network for the Yankees or Fox Sports West for the Dodgers. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? I think I know the answer, so should we just move right along to the next story?
It's an amazing deal, and the one thing that fascinates me is if you break it down, there are 30 teams in baseball just for this part of their TV rights, which is not even the majority of their games, just for this piece of their TV rights, that works out to $50 million per team per year for the national and cable rights to big matchups. First of all, no team should be able to field players or a team for less than $50 million. There's got to be a basement because there are some baseball teams that get kickback money from other teams and they get all a piece of this big TV rights and they don't put a quality team on the field, and that needs to end. But secondly, when people complain about the high salaries of baseball players, try telling them they're not worth tens of millions of dollars when you see billions of dollars going to their owners.
I couldn't agree more.
It's, you know, who should get it but them?
The Brooklyn startup Atavist has made a splash in digital publishing with its multimedia titles for the iPad, but now it's been supercharged with some major financing and powerful publishing heavyweights. Atavist has partnered with mogul Barry Diller, as well as movie and theater producer Scott Rudin, to launch Brightline. Of course, those are two very, you know, they get along quite well. They're very amicable people. So
do they not get along?
No. I mean, Barry Diller and Scott Rudin are known as kind of, they've got personalities, that's for sure.
Oh, but they have no feud or anything.
No, not with each other, just with other people.
They're big personalities, big egos.
Yes. Well, and they are forming a new publishing venture with $20 million in backing. That's what this Brightline is. And all the contacts, of course, that both Barry Diller and Scott Rudin will bring to that party are quite substantial. Add to that industry veteran Francis Cody, who will step in to run it after years at Vintage UK and Picador. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because I think it's fascinating that there's so much turmoil and change and churning going on in publishing that new people believe they can step in and challenge the big six publishers. We talked about the big three record labels. Well, there's a big six in publishing. And these people think they can go in with $20 million, which frankly is a pittance for the $20 billion a year book publishing industry. They can step in and challenge them because of these digital platforms. They believe they can offer services and distribution and competition with the biggest publishers out there. I mean, they're not in here to be a small little boutique label and be cutesy. They want to be players. Scott Rudin has great taste in books. He's always gets every galley of every hot book first, so he can consider to option them for films. He's always right in the mix. And Barry Diller, of course, is a smart mogul in entertainment. And they want to be players. And they see that digital has allowed them to have a chance to start from scratch. You know, you got a blank slate. How would you launch a publishing business in this day and age with a blank slate and compete with the big six? They think they can do it. I think it's fascinating.
Maybe those Olympics paid off after all. NBC used the best time slot it has, Mondays after its hit show, The Voice, to debut the new J.J. Abrams drama, Revolution. The result? NBC's strongest debut in 5 years. Of course, sampling doesn't always mean liking, as you know, Michael. The last NBC show to debut this strongly was The Bionic Woman, and that was canceled after, you know, 8 episodes. Still, you know, sampling is sampling, and Revolution has turned the lights on for NBC. That seems to be the theme of the show. We're turning the lights on. You know, Modern Family left the lights on for broadcast television, and now Revolution has left the lights on for NBC.
Well, I had
NBC.
To say that because the show is about the power going out. Electricity doesn't work anymore, so it was a little dig there, a little joke.
But in any case, is this whole story a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because it's 1 week. We are paying attention. The fall TV shows are opening in the next few weeks. It's a pretty concentrated fall television season, but it's going to take 2 to 3 to 4 weeks for these shows to all debut, and then it's going to take another week or two for them all to get a chance of a second and a third viewing. It's after the third episode where you can really judge how a show is doing. I watched Revolution. I watched the debut episode. I thought it was ridiculous. Stupid show. I hated the casting. I thought the female lead and the young hot male lead, you know, they're all young, pretty people who look like they should be male models and female models. And they're supposed to be wandering around a post-apocalyptic America. And they look like their hair is done and the makeup is perfect. They look absurd. They're in hip-hugging leather pants. I thought the show was absurd. But I'll glance at a second episode, and I'll probably stop watching after that, because that's how these shows go. People sample them, they check them out, and they either stick around or they don't. Most shows will drop in their second and third week, and then, if they're lucky, stabilize. So it's going to take 3 weeks or a month to find out what's going on with Revolution and all the other shows. We're paying attention to them. We're watching them. And in about a month, we'll check in with you and tell you how the shows are really doing, because you can't get too excited or too dismayed over the week one results.
The Academy Awards have entered the 20th century, just in time for the 21st century. Members can now vote online and will be encouraged to do so via voting kiosks in LA, New York, and if I'm not mistaken, London. This allows more flexibility, sort of. Earlier voting, lengthier voting periods, because it's easier to tabulate all those results, and so on. One big bonus, they can announce the Oscar nominees even before the Golden Globe Awards, taking some of the thunder from that event. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. To clarify, people can go to one of those kiosks if they don't have a computer at home, but you can log on anywhere in the world. So people who are on location don't have to worry about getting the physical ballot mailed to them and getting a copy of it and filling it out and sending it back in. It'll be a lot easier for people who are on the set, which of course, that's what Hollywood people do. Be a lot easier for them to participate quickly and easily in the voting process. So I think it's a good thing, but it's certainly not a big deal. I don't think it will change the dynamics particularly. It's nice to have a little extra breathing room to give them even more time to watch the nominees. And so that's got to be a plus. But ultimately, it's just a reasonable step that's long overdue.
Here's why I think this could be a big deal. And first of all, you can't vote from home.
You can.
And no, it says in their press release, you'll have to go to these voting kiosks.
No. That's absolutely not true, because that would destroy the whole purpose of it. They're not forcing you to go to the kiosk. That's insane.
But voters will not be accessing their ballots from their home computer.
You're kidding me.
I kid you not.
That's asinine.
They'll have to go to voting stations created by PricewaterhouseCoopers, and everyone counts in LA, New York, and London, equipped with a 24-hour telephone helpline.
Then it's a big whoop because they're morons. That's not electronic voting. That's come to the booth.
That's polling.
Electronic voting is when you do it at home. It's not when you have to go to a location. That's what you do for the elections. That's ridiculous. That's stupid, asinine morons. I can't believe I missed that.
Yeah, I mean, if you could vote from home, then I would say this is a big deal.
I wouldn't say it's a big deal. I'd say it's like, but they talked about the security measures they had to take and all that, and it's for their own kiosk.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I can't believe I misread that. And I can't believe what morons they are. If they think this makes the slide, how can they change the deadlines because there's a damn kiosk?
Well, because they don't have to have somebody count it.
Well, they do, because most people are not going to bother to go to the kiosk.
That's true.
You're going to stand in a line. You're going to have movie stars go up and stand in line to vote.
You may as well just tell the paparazzi where to stand.
Yeah. Oh my God. And how many kiosks are you going to have? 100 machines? A dozen, 10, 5? Give me a break. That is just as stupid as it gets.
If it was voting at home, I would say it's a big deal, because then people could cast their ballots. They might do so very early because it's very easy to do so. And then, you know, they might vote for somebody who wouldn't ordinarily win if they did something like, you know, had some boneheaded move the way, say, Russell Crowe did at the BAFTAs. He kind of like yelled on stage at the producer afterwards. And he was seen as kind of a spoiled brat during the A Beautiful Mind.
More to the point, they get to wait longer and watch more shows because they can do it an hour before it's due rather than having to make sure it's out in the mail 3 days before, you know.
Right. So it kind of cuts both ways. Yeah.
Oh, well, I can't believe they've set up kiosks as if people are going to line up to vote like it's the presidential election, which is always such a fun experience.
Speaking of the presidential election, you can actually forget about the presidential debates here in the U.S. this October between President Obama and Governor Mitt Romney. The really fun debate will be between Jon Stewart and, get this, Bill O'Reilly on October 6th. They'll face off using the presidential debate format and rules, with some of the proceeds going to charity and the entire event streaming online. Of course, for those of you who don't know, Bill O'Reilly is a political pundit on Fox News. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, if they don't know who Bill O'Reilly is, surely they don't know who Jon Stewart is either.
Good point. He is a political pundit, but he is more of a humorous political pundit.
Or as I would say, everybody knows who both of them are.
Okay.
But this is a big whoop, obviously. It's just an amusing event. However, Stephen Colbert did a great series of stuff this year on Super PACs. Frankly, I thought he perhaps should have won the Emmy for Best Variety Show, whatever that category is. I think he should have won over Jon Stewart this year for that extended series on Super PACs and the idiocy of the rules surrounding them. It was just brilliant stuff. And I think it's a possibility that if Bill O'Reilly and Jon Stewart use the presidential debate format and yet have a substantive, interesting debate, that they could demonstrate how easy it would be to have a real debate. I was puzzled at first that they would use the rules, because those are the things that make it such a boring event. You've got 2 minutes and you've got 1 minute. Then you've got 3 minutes and you've got 2 minutes. And I thought, why not let them have a more fluid, natural debate so they could actually debate the issues? But in fact, they're using that format to try and make a point, I think, that you could be substantial and funny and smart and informed and actually have a real debate. You know, if they're better at the issues than the presidential nominees, I think that'll be interesting.
When NBC's hit show The Voice doubled down and decided to air a new round of the competition show during the spring, opposite American Idol, mind you, they had a big problem, and it wasn't American Idol. Their celebrity judges have busy schedules, and CeeLo Green and Christina Aguilera in particular were not available to join Adam Levine and Blake Shelton, who apparently are doing nothing. So NBC went out and found a new pair of judges for the spring who just happened to have nothing else going on in their careers. We kid, of course. They went with Shakira and Usher. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop until we see how they do. Obviously, every show now can get big celebrities because it's a huge platform and it's the best way to reach an audience. It's better than the radio. It's better than record sales because people aren't buying albums. So if you want to build an audience for your concert tours, being on television is a great way to do it. How many people know Blake Shelton now that didn't know his name 2 years ago? So Shakira and Usher, are they good choices? Are they bad choices? We have no idea. You know, an obscure artist can be a great choice because they're really good on camera and make good judgments. And a famous artist can be a train wreck if they're not willing to critique and be smart and savvy and to the point. And the big thing about The Voice, I think, is they do have great chemistry with their four core judges. They tease each other. They taunt each other. They have to plead with contestants to choose them and be on their team. It's an interesting format. It's why the show has worked. So putting in two new people is a very big change. I hate the fact that they're doing a second show in the spring.
I couldn't agree more. I think they're going to beat it. I couldn't agree more. They're going to beat it to death.
Right. Everybody loses from this. Everybody loses. You get two new judges. You got to worry about the chemistry. And you just get sicker and sicker of all these singing competitions.
Companies are circling the assets of AEG. That's the Anschutz Entertainment Group. And that is the conglomerate that includes holdings in entertainment and sports, including arenas and venues all over the world, such as the Staples Center in LA and I think the O2 Arena in London. They own the Los Angeles Kings, the Galaxy soccer team, and a piece of the Lakers. But what's not included in the deal would be the largest movie theater chain in the U.S., Regal Cinemas, and the family film company Walden Media, which, you know, if you've heard of it, you've probably heard of it because it's known for the Chronicle of Narnia series. So is AEG's being up for sale and the exclusion of its film industry holdings a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I'm going to channel our old friend Karen Woodward and say it's a big whoop. Media company sells assets. So what?
Okay, well, let's talk about another media company then. After a lengthy investigation spurred on by a phone hacking scandal, a British regulator declared the BSkyB, which is a satellite company in the UK, they declare them fit and proper, and that's a quote, and my gosh, don't they know it. The company owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is so confident in their innocence, they are keeping the tainted James Murdoch around to play a big role in their American TV assets, overseeing Fox, FX, regional sports networks, and other key assets among the most valuable in News Corp's portfolio. They will also likely follow up on the dream of James Murdoch and start pursuing the rest of BSkyB, which has always been his real wish. And of course, they own a controlling interest in BSkyB. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. You can see that they just don't care. They've had this massive scandal rock their company. People are going on trial. People are being arrested. James Murdoch was tainted, and they're just plowing ahead. They figure people will get bored with the story and look the other way, and that seems to be what's happening.
Yes, I'm a little surprised that they're basically putting... We all said this would happen. We all knew James Murdoch would be back if they were found not culpable of all of this stuff. And it's not that they haven't been found innocent of phone hacking. It's just that they said, BSkyB, nothing was wrong there, that the company itself was being run properly.
That's right.
There's no accountability, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, when you're a billionaire running an international multi-conglomerate, you expect to get your way.
That's true. I suppose you're right.
But you can't always get your way, and you can't always keep the people you want, no matter how much you beg and plead.
Well, yes, Michael, I kind of get what you're talking about. You must be talking about our guest for Inside Baseball this week, Jeff Boucher. Now, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And Jeff Boucher has had the industry buzzing now for, well, I guess, th- through the entire month of September. And I had this grand plan that Jeff has ruined here. You know, Jeff Boucher, of course, he's been on the show several times, and he is or was the editor of the Hero Complex over at the Los Angeles Times and worked for the Los Angeles Times. As we told you, he left the Los Angeles Times, I guess it was last week, and our big plan, at least my big plan, was to bring Jeff on to explain, you know, his departure from the Los Angeles Times for one show, and then at a later show to bring him on to explain where he was going and what his new position was and where we could find his work. And Jeff completely ruined that by actually landing in Entertainment Weekly in less than a week, so now we can only have him on, you know, to discuss all of these things one time, and I have to find a guest for a future episode. So, Jeff, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, it's good to be here.
Unfortunately, Jeff was being sort of blunt in the media. It always has great memories of the LA Times. He worked there for 21 years, but now he's settled an agreement with the LA Times. He's moved on to Entertainment Weekly. Contracts have been signed. So instead of giving us the dirt on the LA Times, I'm afraid Jeff will probably be saying no comment to most of our questions. So, Jeff, how are you doing today?
No comment.
Exactly. Thank you very much. You have a career in stand-up.
I'm doing very well, thanks. Things are good. I will comment on that, Michael. I'm doing very, very well, and I'm really excited about the stuff over at EW, you know, and all the promise that that I see over there.
Well, you were in print at the Los Angeles Times, and you're staying with print. I think a lot of people are, at least in the entertainment media world, were surprised that you landed at a place that was also considered, well, not necessarily, well, it's considered old media rather than new media.
Yeah, you know, I can probably, I'm not surprised by that. Although, you know, the closer you get to things and inspect them up close, the more you realize that general perceptions are not always that great. See, to me, the stuff that I'm known for, since I don't do reviews, I don't do critiques, I don't really do gossip, you know, I do mostly just really big features and then stuff on, you know, the things I'm passionate about, which, you know, graphic novels and sci-fi films and all the stuff that has, you know, been on Hero Complex. And the access that I get on movie sets that other people can't get on, like Inception and Dark Shadows and, you know, Dark Knight Rises for, you know, a couple days, none of those would happen without a print component. You know, that's the difference between getting that story and not getting it, you know. For instance, Christopher Nolan will not do an interview unless it's a print publication. He will not do an interview with a website. He doesn't think it's worth his time, or I shouldn't say that. He doesn't think it's what he wants to do. I don't know why. You know, you have to ask him that. But
well, actually, I have asked him that, and he said that you know, he doesn't really use a computer. Or you know, except to type some of his screenplays. But he doesn't have an email address. So for him, he doesn't really see he doesn't really care how impactful new media is, because for him, it's not all that impactful at all.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't even have a cell phone either.
Right.
Which is, I think, one of the reasons he gets so many things done. you know, you know, to me, you know, the idea of old media, new media, it doesn't really kind of affect the way I judge things, quite honestly, because it's just too vague. You know, I was very lucky that I had about 8 offers, and from a variety of different types of outfits. I mean, pure online, traditional, you know, names that you would expect, and then some kind of curveball things I wasn't anticipating, and they were all very, very flattering, and they were all based on, you know, the work that I did at the Times, which I'm very appreciative of, you know. And you know, I didn't leave on the best of terms, but I was there for 21 years and had 2,800 stories published in print and I don't know how many online, and I just adored the place. But, you know, the success story of Hero Complex is at old media. I mean, you know, everything that I did there, you know, we were on track for 50 million hits this year. You know, we've been calling tradigital, which is where a traditional sort of media outlet uses the resources it has, the credibility it has, the platform it has, and innovates online, you know. And the model there that I, you know, was so happy about was using print to push online, to push live events, push back full circle. You know, to me, it's all that stuff put together. And we were able to do a lot of very prominent things, very high quality things, and get tremendous access that no one else got by being all of those things. And to me, you know, to say that it's old media kind of ignores the, you know, that success right there. With EW, they saw that and they are very, very, very interested in doing a similar success story over on their platform now. And that's exactly what I'm going to be doing.
What will you do fresh or what will you do new? Do you have a chance to start from scratch in a sense, building the brand like your Hero Complex? What have you learned that you're going to perhaps bring to that?
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff. Leaving behind that name, Hero Complex, is kind of hard for me. It's my baby. And the reason it ended up, I think, being somewhat a special story, I think, you know, even people at the Times will describe as, along with the envelope, being the most successful brand creation of the paper in the last 25 years, is that when it started, it was just me doing what I wanted because nobody cared about it. And then, so it kind of had a singular sort of voice to it, which made it easy to understand. I think a lot of times online, one of the problems is the difference between good and great is what you don't do, I think. You know, there was a lot, once Hero Complex started getting popular, there was people that would, in the office, that would bring me things like, you know, say, hey, we got you a Jackass screen for Hero Complex. I'm like, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, it's not what we cover. And they're like, yeah, but the studio is going to pay the paper to do it, you know, because we had this advertising marketing event package that they would offer people. But I said I would only do that program if I had veto power over the films. And that was one of the ones I vetoed, for instance. And the funny thing is, it was the second one. So it was difficult to veto it at that time because there was some capital in the building. People were like resistant to, you know, turn down something when it's just started.
So this is the screening program, just to let our listeners know. This is, you started a screening program, a Hero Complex kind of a almost extended film festival where, you know, periodically you'd have a film that you would show with an audience and then you'd have a Q&A afterwards. And but they were relevant films to what Hero Complex, which was really focused on pop culture and comic books and comics. But Jackass really doesn't fit into that. So you said, look, no way, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, precisely. Thank you. That's precisely right. And the way it worked is it was a partnership with IMAX for many of the screens. That one was not with IMAX, actually, because it was predated. But, and then the studios would come to the marketing advertising side of the LA Times, and they would buy a screening that I would host and do a Q&A afterwards with a director or star, as you say. But that bundle came with ads in print, publication ads on the website, social media, stuff like that. And
so that tradigital thing that you were talking about, that whole package.
Exactly. And so that was one where, you know, it was not tone appropriate. It was, if it's a movie we're not going to write about, why would we put our name on, you know, on this thing? So one of the things I learned, that was a very circuitous answer to, you know, one of the key things I learned is, you know, stand by your definitions of what it is. You know, I think one of the reasons we were really successful too is because so much of the online stuff, you know, people don't have the access that we have. And most people, if you can't get access, you know, they veer into a tone of either celebration or mockery. You know, everybody, if you can't get Johnny Depp on the phone, you know, you're going to just talk about what you think about him and think about his movies. And a lot of times in the sort of Comic-Con sector, that becomes very, very sort of gushing or very, very
trolly. You
know, trollish indeed. So, you know, we had a little motto that I told everybody on the team, which was, you know, insight is harder than insult. And we're going to do it, you know. So that's, you know, going to be a compass point starting out. You know, as time went on, we never did casting rumors. We never did anything that we thought was just repeating or parroting what other websites were doing, which people spend tons of time doing that. Like there's entire sites that are just built on, here's what, you know, Ain't It Cool said, here's what, you know, Bleeding Cool said, here's what Never Been Cool said. And you're always the tail of the kite. You know, you'll never, ever, you become a sort of a court reporter for the rumor hall. So, you know, stuff like that. And then there's specific things about, you know, SEO and headlines and things like that. But to me, the key is remembering that sort of, you know, the triangle between live events, which you videotape and do high quality and edit, and which creates content for online, and then online pushes people to the live events. The video gets you credibility, and then the print publication is the thing that gets you access to the very top people. So, you know, just kind of remembering that model, I think, is the main thing.
Do you have a name for what you might be doing over at EW, or is that down the road?
I have three possibilities, and I'm waiting because, you know, this is going to be very much a team project. You know, I started on October 1st, but I'm going into a shop that has some fantastic people in it, and that's actually one of the reasons I jumped at the chance to work there, quite honestly. Once I sort of spread out all these offers on the table, this is the one that absolutely made the most sense. And you know, working with people like Jeff Jensen and Anthony Bresnican over there, who I've been a friendly competitor with, you know, for years now, and see them again and again because they're sort of in the same sectors as me. I mean, Jeff's a big comic book geek like me. He's, you know, he and I can sit and talk about Stanley Kubrick films for like hours and have. Anthony Bresnican is, you know, great at, you know, he did their big Avengers cover this year. He grew up as a big Transformers fan and sort of understands the culture of popcorn films these days. And both these guys are also just super, super nice people. They're really thoughtful and generous. And I think you can't really, I think that gets undervalued sometimes in the work culture, is how easy are people to get along with. And it sounds a little trite or maybe simplistic, but, you know, when you're dealing with deadlines and you're dealing with studios and you're dealing with high stakes journalism and trying to get exclusives and stuff, staying next to people that you trust, that you like, and that you can count on is pretty outstanding. So, you know, we haven't decided yet if we're going to call ourselves the Justice League or maybe the Creature Commandos or, I don't know. You know, Bresnican wants to be Optimus Prime, but I don't think he's tall enough.
Plus, I think, you know, while he's well built, I don't know necessarily as, you know, he doesn't strike me as very metallic. Just, you know. you mentioned that, you know, you really just liked Anthony Bresnican and some of the folks over at EW as people, that they were genuine people. And I think when you left the Los Angeles Times, when it was officially announced that you were leaving, there was kind of an outpouring of grief, if you will. And it was the second outpouring because the first came upon the rumors at the beginning of September that you might not be with the LA Times any longer. And then the second wave came when it was officially announced. I mean, you were known as somebody who was very easy to get along with. You were there for 21 years, and that really you were a team player. What is it about you in an industry where, let's face it, a lot of people are, you know, struggling to make a living in this industry, in journalism, where you say, look, I understand that I could take this for myself. I could take this position for myself and better my own career, but I'm going to be a team player. And maybe we should all be doing this in the entertainment division or in the surrounding environment. What makes you do that?
It just feels like the right thing to do. I've always enjoyed being part of a team. It just seems like it's a much easier way to go through life. You know, as Michael knows, I mean, he and I came from the University of Florida working for the same school paper, working side by side. And there was a sort of a tribal feel. There was a real sense of, you know, the people here are the people that not only do I work with, but the people I like and the people I identify with and the people that, and there's also something that happens when you're in a newsroom where it gets overly competitive, or if you're in a newsroom where it gets overly political, you also lose the sort of the crackle of ideas. The circuitry of a newsroom can really be powerful if everybody's talking to each other. And as soon as people stop talking to each other or start kind of isolating more, you really start losing the tremendous advantage of having the sounding board of all the professionals around you, but also their wealth of experience, their Rolodex or their sources, and just the general energy you get from bouncing ideas off of one another. You know, when I write a story, I kind of start it by going and rehearsing it by telling my colleagues or friends about an interview. Like, I just interviewed Clint Eastwood and this and happened. And then I'll tell it to another person, but I'll tell it a different way. And as I'm doing that, I'm kind of rehearsing different approaches to the writing. And if I'm alone all the time, it doesn't really work as well because no one ever answers. So I just like the sound of people's voices and being part of something. I know that a lot of people were very upset when I left the paper. I've been there a long time. I got there when I was 21, and now 21 years later, I'm leaving. And I'm excited. There's going to be a party about a week from now, with the staff and the band and all this kind of stuff. And it just means an awful lot to me. But I'm not canceling my subscription. I love the paper, and I always will. And my wife Tracy is going to continue to work there. She's had a tremendous career there, and is beloved at the paper. And I'm very, very happy that she's staying there.
And you're being somewhat modest because that band is U2 and the E Street Band. But I mean,
it's actually U2 and the Fantastic Four. It's oddly.
Was it a little strange or surreal or just wildly ego stoking to see the coverage that you're leaving the LA Times and what might be happening to you? Play out in the media the way it did? People were calling you, people were writing stories. Were you sort of, was it a little surreal, give you a glimpse of what it's like to be a celebrity, or were you like, this is awesome?
No, not at all. And because you got to remember too, is when I quit, I didn't have I hadn't even talked to EW, So, I mean, I didn't quit with a job lined up. I had been hearing from people in recent months, there's people that made overtures and, boy, if you ever need a place to go or blah, 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 So, I mean, I was confident that some one of those would lead to something. So, I mean, but it's still, it was a jagged moment, with a lot of different emotions and a lot of self-questioning, like, am I doing the right thing? How am I reacting the way I should? Am I doing this the right thing and for the right reasons? I think I did, and as you say, there was a tremendous response. My cell phone would ring and it was Lauren Shuler Donner calling to say, everybody in the industry respects you. Everybody in the industry, wants to see you do well and they want to read you, whether they're reading about themselves or other people. J.J. Abrams called, can you come by the office just to talk, and then, hearing from people like Marty Baron, the editor-in-chief of the Boston Globe. Just, different colleagues through the years, people all over the country that I've worked with and stuff who I think were shocked because I think that they thought if there was one person, well, Russ Stanton, the editor-in-chief of the LA, the former editor-in-chief of the LA Times, told me on the phone, when we spoke, he goes, if they were starting the LA Times over with five people, you would be one of the five, so everybody's a little surprised.
Well, the shock, I think, was because you were doing exactly what everybody says media needs to do, creating a presence online, a distinctive voice, creating a brand. I'm wondering, as you moved to EW, you created the Hero Complex. It brought tremendous value to the LA Times. You're moving to EW now. You have a new contract. You've come up with new terms. Will you own the name to what you're creating? Will you own a piece of the traffic that will there be bonuses or will there be direct participation in what you build up there? Or how is that working? What did you think about?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things that are in place. Yeah, there's some direct language in there about the traffic and the success of a particular brand. The website that is going to happen, or subsite, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it. Because we call them blogs, but I don't really know what the word means anymore. Because I've been described as a blogger. I don't know that what I did was ever really a blog. I mean, it was more just kind of a themed hub of representative coverage of my weird brain. Yeah, so no, the success of that will have direct benefits for me. But and then there's a second brand that I can't talk about yet. There's a second project that, in addition to the sort of obvious one, but there's a follow-up thing that I'm doing with EW and with somebody else in a different medium that I own. And that's coming a little later down the line.
TV?
Those may be the correct letters. It's a TV thing, hopefully. It does not involve J.J. Abrams, despite what Deadline Hollywood has created in their unique hot dog factory, which does not smell good the closer you get to it.
Well, you know, it does include Ryan Seacrest, however, because, you know, you really can't do anything in Hollywood now without him.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. We're just going to, it's actually called the Ryan Seacrest Show. But I'm going to play Ryan Seacrest. So.
That would be very meta. I was wondering if a studio approached you, because as I thought about where you might go, the unexpected thing, but a sort of a logical path might have been some studio who thought, you have great connections, you have great relationships, you know the comic book world, a lot of movies and TV shows are based on them, and maybe someone reached out to you and said, would you be interested in developing projects for us and properties and films or television shows?
And let me just translate what Michael means by a lot of these movies and television shows are based on comic books. He means all of them.
Yeah, exactly. I think the next big wave is going to be video games. I think, you know, we'll see that. I think
Wreck-It Ralph.
You know, yeah. Oh man, that looks good to me.
It really does.
I think it looks great. And I think you're going to see a lot of video game brands, because I think people are going to kind of loosen up and realize that the best way to make a video game is to do, you know, what Pirates of the Caribbean did, which is where you just use the touchstones of it and feel of it and add and embellish and take it in a new direction. But anyway, that's not your question. There was some studio interest, and I don't know if I want to say who specifically, you know, just because I'll probably be writing about them in the future, and I don't want people trying to read between the lines and stuff like that. But I mean, it never got super far. And I think part of it was, as you say, you know, they know me. I think that they think highly of my, you know, expertise. I know more about this. I know more about nothing than anyone, as my wife says. That's where maybe at the beginning there was a little ego, like, oh, wow, it's so cool that they called. And you go over and they, you know, they give you coffee that's in really huge cups. I don't know why. It's like Super Bowl cups and tell you about the airplane that you can fly on and all this stuff. But then I quickly realized, you know, I didn't get here. I just don't know if I'm that guy. I'm not going to jump out of that job and go try something that I haven't tried before. I feel like I'm on to something special doing what I do, and what I do, I understand, and it's plenty, you know, it's what the fear was that you would kind of listen to the siren song of, you know, the Hollywood, you know, Dream Factory and its promises and stuff. But what if I go over there, if I don't know how to write a script? I've never written a script. Or what if the people that are there aren't necessarily looking out for my best interests, and you don't know the politics of it all and all that stuff. But anyway, so it just seemed like me that any equity I've built up and any credibility I have and stuff like that, I would be gone as soon as I was described as a former journalist. You know, then I'm just another guy in Hollywood. You know, that stuff, I kind of turned that stuff off pretty quickly.
Well, that's actually very interesting. A lot of people would not have done that. They would have, as you say, succumbed to the Hollywood Dream Factory. Their egos would have been boosted. And it is hard not to succumb to that, because it is a very enticing allure. But what really strikes me is that, I mean, you have been doing this a long time, being a journalist, whether it was in the entertainment world or before that. I guess you were on the Metro desk, if I'm not mistaken.
I covered like gangs and crime for 6 years. I did politics and I did rock and roll.
Right. And I guess what's interesting to me is you did something, and you really made this huge name for yourself doing something at a very traditional outlet, the Los Angeles Times, almost because they didn't really even understand what you were doing. And therefore, you were able to do just what you liked and not be bothered. And by doing that, you were able to not only have a huge success for yourself, but a huge success for the team you were working with, and a huge success for the paper itself. And they almost didn't understand it. So just by just leaving you alone and pure ignorance, everybody wound up a winner.
You know, when it started, no one was paying attention, but they let me do it, you know, and they you know, kind of set it up. You know, when I came to I came and pitched the idea, they're like, sure, okay, Jeff, you do great stuff. It'll, you know, if this is what you're excited about. And I mean, so there wasn't, you know, I wouldn't want to make it sound like they were kind of wholly oblivious or unsupportive. And then in fairly short order, some people around the building saw it, and some people outside the building saw it. But the people in the building that saw it and said, "Hey, this is cool," or "Hey, this is an opportunity." And what they did took it, you know, so it quickly got apostles in the building. Not everybody understood it, you know, but I think everybody, you know, understood. The people that didn't understand it knew me, you know, because I'd been there for so long, and I never felt unsupported or mistrusted. And then there were certain people like, you know, Jeff Dellinger, who came up, you know, who on the marketing and advertising business side, who really made it his baby. Like, on, if you go, his business card, on one side it's LA Times, and the other side he had Hero Complex on it. You know, I didn't even have that. And he's the reason that him and Paul Mira and their team are the reason that, you know, it won Ad Age Brand of the Year, you know, Best New Brand a few years ago, because of the film series that we do and the film festival. And, you know, I couldn't have done that stuff without them. And then Sally Hoffmeister, the managing editor of Features Entertainment Coverage, you know, she totally got behind me. She came to one of the events. She came and watched me interview Warren Beatty about Dick Tracy, you know, in front of like 400 people, and said, "Now I get it." And basically said, "What do you need? Let's get you more help. Let's get you a producer. Let's, you know." So it was a sweet confluence of events of, you know, kind of, as you say, you know, this passion of me, a kid who had 9,000 comic books, and I still have them. You know, they're here if you want to take a look.
Much to the chagrin of your wife, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. She's, well, yeah. You have no idea.
And do you know what's going to happen to it? I mean, do you know what happens to Hero Complex? And the team that you were working with must be very demoralized, I guess might be the proper word.
Yeah, I know they're going to carry it forth. I know that that the leadership feels that the brand is too well known to just go let it go fallow. I'll be interested to see if it stays outside the paywall. I think that's something to watch for, because right now there's not very many things outside the paywall for the LA Times, but the Hero Complex is one of them, because it gets such a young readership and such an out of town readership. I mean, some of the numbers, I think, was like, not sure about this, but if I remember right, it was 78% outside Southern California, and the 17 to 35 male was like 80% readership. I mean, it was really, really a powerful demographic for folks, or it was a powerful number for folks seeking that demographic, I should say. I don't know if they're going to have one lead writer or if they're going to kind of do a team thing. There's still a lot of people there that I really, really, really care about. And I'll be doing anything I can to help them. If, you know, if they call, I'll answer. And if, and I told the editors, if it's somebody I know and respect that takes over, I'll be happy to write a post handing it off. You know, my last day on the payroll is the 28th. But it'll be interesting to see how it does. I don't know how the film festival will work, because, you know, we've had big names there. We've had three film festivals. We had Leonard Nimoy and Ridley Scott. We had Christopher Nolan, John Favreau, Robert Downey Jr. And all those guys came because I called them and asked them to come. You know, none of them were paid. None of them were put up in a hotel. None of them were flown in. And it's not that easy to get people to do it. Just the timing alone, and you know, kind of, there's a lot of, you know, it's like Tinkerbell. You know, everybody has to believe, make it work. And so I don't know how that's going to happen. I don't know what form that's going to take next year, next May, if they're going to do it, or if they're going to do it in a different way. Well,
I know that it's been quite a month here, at least in Los Angeles and in the entertainment journalism world, because of not only yourself, but Patrick Goldstein leaving the Los Angeles Times.
And film editor.
And a columnist. The film editor, as you just said, Michael.
No, I'm saying didn't you lose a top editor of the film section in the LA Times as well, Jeff?
Patrick left, and then Julie Mackinnon, who's the film editor, is now in the China office, I believe, China Bureau.
Well, and I mean, I think what was so, well, not interesting is the wrong word, a word I use as a crutch, I suppose, because it's it was very telling, I suppose, or very notable, because the day Patrick Goldstein left and wrote his last column, Ann Thompson of IndieWire, who was just on last week's show talking about Telluride and Toronto, the film festivals there, mentioned that the new idea of a journalist, the new journalist is Jeff Boucher, who does online, and has his own blog, and does the Hero Complex, and has the film festival going and the screening series, and also is this fantastic journalist. And in less than a week later, it's somewhat rumored that you're leaving as well. And I think that's what really shocked people, is everybody kind of agreed with Anne that, yes, you know, Patrick Goldstein is a great columnist. And is there a place for columnists in today's newspaper? I would say yes. I think most people would say yes, and pointed at you. And I think a lot of people said, but yes, I think, you know, the Jeff Boucher model is probably the future. And then the future died in less than a week.
I didn't die.
Well, no, but I mean, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It is a difficult time. And I would say to, you know, just my peers, like, journalists, I'm maybe north of 35, or like me, north of 40, is that, you know, I think it's just embracing the new and jumping into the new possibilities. And there's just tremendous possibilities out there. And I'm very proud that people would think that, you know, what I've done there is a model for what can be done and should be done. And I would point out that it was done at a newspaper, and that every single newspaper could do a similar thing by just going to their staff, finding out what they're passionate about, giving them a sense of real control over a piece of real estate. You know, like, you know, I felt like I controlled Hero Complex, you know, and I worked with people. And then once you have a real stake in it and a sense of this new conversation, you know, this new conversation with the reader and this new conversation with the information and the possibilities of it, it's really pretty exciting. You know, I mean, one of the things that I tried to always do as the thing really started to grow, I stepped back and said, you know, this could be really special. And I tried to think of how to approach it. And I tried in a lot of ways to approach the way Jan Wenner approached rock and roll. I mean, as far as just sort of curation through celebration and bringing, like, you know, hopefully world-class journalism standards to an area that is seen by many people as being disposable or overly ragged or maybe too youth oriented, and just kind of getting in there and living and breathing it, but always being driven by a sense of wonder and appreciation. I mean, you always got a sense that Jan Wenner loved music, that Jan Wenner loved rock and roll and pop culture. And, you know, what he did with Rolling Stone was to take music seriously, and then also realize it wasn't just music, and, you know, this thing I was doing wasn't just film, it was also video games and graphic novels and illustration and even animation, and just kind of make sure that you aren't a tourist. Don't ever sound like a tourist, and you know, hold your credibility, don't sell out, but never be afraid to look enthusiastic.
Well, certainly, I guess I can, I don't know, Michael, I'll speak for you as well, but I certainly personally look forward to seeing what you do over at Entertainment Weekly. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time to speak with us, not only about Entertainment Weekly, but what was going on at the LA Times and your transition to a new position.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It's great talking to you guys. And I'll be in touch. We're going to need help getting this thing off the ground.
Well, we look forward to helping any way we can.
All right. I'll see you guys.
Thanks
a lot, Jeff. Well, it was great of Jeff to stop by. I'm really excited to see what he does at EW.
Likewise. I mean, I think, the interview said it all. I mean, you know, there was a great outpouring when it was known that he was leaving the LA Times. I think a lot of people were shocked. And, you know, they look forward to seeing, like I do, what he does at EW. I'm sure that he will be very successful.
Well, the nice thing about Time Warner is once you get in there, you'll never leave, because their benefits are so terrific that you have golden handcuffs. I mean, once you're in the Time Warner world, it's really hard to walk away, because you give up so much. They really do not stint on the benefits for their top employees.
I mean, first of all, you'd lose that, you know, free subscription to Time Magazine. So right off the bat, you wouldn't want to leave.
Okay.
But Michael, as you know, you don't have to pay for a subscription to Showbiz Sandbox.
That's true.
In fact, you can subscribe to it for free in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher. You can sign up for a feed burner email. We'll send you an email once a week when we post a new episode. You can subscribe to it in your RSS reader, any podcast aggregator or podcast catcher. And we really encourage you to do so and encourage you to rate and review the show on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or any of those podcast directories. It really does help us out. You can also email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us at Twitter, where our username is showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found under showbizsandbox. In fact, showbizsandbox.com is where you will find links to all of the stories we talked about on today's episode. Again, that's showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found in New York City or on his website, which is
michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.